I think with the age of 29, he became a member of parliament in colonial Kenya. And in fact, I was told he was the first one to tell off Tom Mboya in parliament when he interjected at his first speech. So he made a name for himself as a coastal and national politician at a very early age. And then subsequently, in the years directly before independence, he was the leader of a coastal independence movement of the coastal strip, which was a protectorate. And in Kenya, we had the coastal strip, which belonged as a protectorate to Zanzibar. And so the pre-independence negotiations, whether or not the coastal strip could or should be a part of Kenya, and Wecher Abdoulaye leading an independence movement that was making a mark for Mwambao, for the Kenyan coastal strip as an independent country. That was, of course, unsuccessful. But he participated as one of the negotiators in Lancaster House in London, and he was one of the two representatives of that movement to refuse to sign that agreement at the time. From the early political activity, what should also then be noted is a very important activity as an editor and later on director for Oxford University Press East Africa. I think we can safely say that Oxford University Press East Africa, especially when we look at what they published in Swahili at the time, in the early 70s, is still be marked as a great phase. He edited Julius Nyerere's translations of Shakespeare into Swahili, among other things. And he was first, as I said, an editor, then a director later on in Oxford University Press. In between, he had founded his own publishing house in Nairobi, Shungwaya Publishers, also with some very important publications, among others, the translation, or part of the translation of Sheikh Alamin Mazrui of the Quran. And so that's another important aspect to remind us of. And the third one is his activities as an Islamic scholar. He was linked to, in his earlier days of education, to several important scholars, and especially Said Omar Abdallah in Zanzibar, Sheikh Al-Ghazali, Muhammad Ghazali in Mombasa, to name two very important ones. Ali Abu Bakr, another one. He was also a teacher at the Arab Boys' School in Mombasa. And he also had important links to Sheikh Mohammed Qasim Mazrui. So just for some of you to have some names, perhaps some of you can relate to. And of course, Sheikh Abdoulaye is known in that during the 1980s, he became a Shia publicly. He stood up and has become sort of a galleon figure of, say, African converts, Swahili converts to Shiism, a minority which has grown with some strength over the last few decades. And you can see some of his writing activities since the late 80s in that capacity you can see here on the table. And I just would like to mention that actually, if you use the internet, there's actually a lot of his speeches, publications to be found either in audio, sort of in audio and even video nature, and also in written nature as well. So I don't want to lose any more of your time and our time. So thank you very much, Sheikh Abdoulaye, for coming here and agreeing to talk to us. I should say perhaps that you asked me to say that English is not your preferred language of expression, and I understand that. He is known very much as a mzungumzaji mzuri, so a very good speaker who makes people think with his speeches and keeps his audiences active. And I'm very sure and confident that that will happen today as well. Isipukuani kwabahati mbayani kingereza lakini. Thank you very much, Sheikh Abdoulaye. So, please, go ahead. The title of the lecture is Kenyan Muslims and the Writing of Historical Injustices, the Case of Mwambao. Thank
you. I don't know how to start. As Brother Kai has mentioned, I think I could have done greater justice to the subject had I been allowed to speak in Kiswahili. The reason being, I've left addressing people in English for the last 28 years. Since I moved to Mombasa from Nairobi, I've never spoken in English in any gathering. But you'll pardon me if you find my English a bit rusty, because it has been in store for 28 years. I would also like to take this opportunity to thank the ZMO for their invitation to us to come and spend time with you, during which, to date, Bwanakai has taken great care of us, plus, of course, his assistants. For this, I say thank you. Now, the subject suggested to me is Kenya Muslims and the writing of historical injustices, the case of Mambao. Before going into the subject proper, I think there are two words, two names in that title which we need to know about. This is Kenya and Mambao. We have to understand what Kenya was before independence and what Kenya is after independence. Just as we have to know what Mambao was before independence and what it is after independence. Kenya before independence minus Mambao was known as Kenya Colony under a British governor. It was ruled by Britain. Mambao was a 10-mile strip which before Britain had an agreement with the Sultan in 1895 was under the Sultan of Zanzibar. This was a 10-mile coastal strip, which of course is much older than the Kenya colony. The 10-mile strip was known as Kenya Protectorate, and the other part of Kenya was the Kenya colony. So this was a country in two parts, and every part of this country, the Kenya colony and the Kenya Protectorate, had its character, which is very important in appreciating the developments that followed. Both of them were under a British governor. The governor was in Nairobi. He was the governor of the Kenya colony and protectorate. Although the protectorate was the Sultan's territory. Now, there was a difference in the behavior of the Kenya colony and the Kenya protectorate. There was a difference in the behavior, the relationship between the rulers and the ruled. And this, in reflection, determined their respective behaviors. Under Kenya colony, those who were in Kenya colony, the Africans who were in Kenya colony, the treatment they got from the government was rough, hostile, even brutal. And this was largely because of the influence of the settlers. The settlers were very strong. They had a lot of influence on the administration. In fact, the governor, in some cases, was subservient to the settlers. Now, the settlers were very brutal, and this was reflected in what the government came up with in the form of the laws of the country. The Kenya Protectorate, although it was under the same governor, the relation was somewhat human and civil. It wasn't as rough as it was in the colony. There was some respect for the Sultan's people. Those who were the Sultan's subject had a different treatment they got from the administration, unlike those in the Kenya colony. This automatically was reflected in the behavior of those of the two parts of the country. Those who were under Kenya colony were aggressive. I think this was a reaction to the type of treatment they were getting from the settlers and the government. They were very aggressive, in some cases very rough, very hostile, and to a certain degree uncouth. Those who were in the Kenya Protectorate were somewhat passive, very humble, and very civil. They weren't getting the treatment they were getting, which their counterparts in the colony were getting. So it tended to to make them sort of docile. They wouldn't react to any of the misadministration by the governor. Now, this brought about the attitude of the upcountry people, that is the colony people, to the people of the protectorate. The people of upcountry found the coast people as being very soft, sometimes very meek, and in most cases, because they had not been exposed to the English education, very backward. They looked down upon them as people who had no knowledge. This attitude emerged much more expressly during the struggle for independence, with most of the leaders of the colony were hostile to the presence of Sultan's citizens in the country, because they did not believe that that part of the country rightly belonged to the Sultan. In fact, one of the leaders, when we were in Lancaster House conference, referred to the Sultan as a thief. And it was common in their campaigns against the coastal people to refer to the Sultan and the Arabs as slave traders, and the coastal people as very indolent, lazy people who would not work but would wait for coconuts to drop from the tree and pick them up. Now this, in a way, was arrogance. The upcountry people were very arrogant, and particularly with the major tribes who were at that time leading the independence movement. There was this arrogance, largely by the Gema community, that is Gikuyu, Embu, Meru, Kamba, plus Luos. They were very aggressive in their campaigns, and this frightened the lesser tribes, the smaller tribes in the Kenya colony, just as it did with the coastal people. Now, when they stepped up their campaign, the small tribes in the colony came up with a form of a defense in fighting for what was called Majimboism, that is, regionalism. So their stand, the smaller tribes, was that when we gain independence, Kenya country should not be governed by a central government, but it should have regional governments as well. So they opted for a sort of a federation of the areas that were populated by the smaller tribes to avoid being ruled over by the big tribes. This was as far as the Kenya colony was concerned. In the Kenya protectorate, this provoked what was known as Mwambaoism. Mwambao being a Swahili word, which gained prominence during the struggle. Mwambaoism being a fight to have Mwambao apart from the Kenya colony. Of course, the coastal people themselves weren't united on this. There were almost five groups. There was the group that wanted to be integrated with Zanzibar, come under the Sultan of Zanzibar. There was a group that wanted integration with Kenya colony, so that there is only one Kenya, that Kenya colony and protectorate be one. There were those who thought the Mwambao should be independent of Zanzibar and independent of Kenya colony. And there were those who thought the relationship between Mwambao and Zanzibar should be federal, and those who thought the relation between the colony and Mwambao should be federal. This was, of course, discussed at length at the London conference, Lancaster House conference, where Zanzibar political parties, Kenya colony parties, political parties participated as well as those from Mambao. Now this discussion went on for a long time, and finally the Sultan was advised by the political leaders in Zanzibar to give up the protectorate to Kenya. In other words, it should be one Kenya and no longer two different parts of the same country. Now, the Sultan, of course, came up with the condition. The condition was there would be no interference in the religion of those who were his subjects, and the culture would be preserved as well. So this was agreed, and this was the greatest fear the Mambaois had, that following the threats of the upcountry politicians in their campaigns, that they would remove all these, anything to do with the Sultan, any culture, and we would not have any relation with the Arabs. The usual thing, I mean, Arabs will go home, Indians will go home, Europeans will go home. Now, this agreement that we had at the Lancaster House Conference was reconfirmed by the exchange of letters between the Prime Minister of Zanzibar, this is Mr. Shamte, and the Prime Minister of Kenya, this is Mr. Kenyatta. There was this exchange of letter where Kenya government, now the Kenya independent government, would undertake to make sure that there would be no erosion of the culture and religion of the Sultan's ex-subjects. So this was, in short, the background to the struggle that prompted the subject of the fears that the Muslims largely had. Now, immediately after independence, where the subjects of the Sultan had expected, following the signing of the exchange of letters, that they would be taken care of, immediately after that, the first being, the first one in the injustices was the disregard of that letter. It would be said publicly that yes, people agreed to have it, but in practice, there was this discrimination against the Sultan's subject, who were almost all Muslims. They would be discriminated in giving them jobs. No jobs would be given to them. There was an undertaking that Arabic would continue to be taught in schools. It was dropped. Islamics was continued, but not under Muslim teachers, because Muslims were being barred from joining teacher training colleges, very selective in appointing them to these posts. So it would be left to non-Muslim teachers teaching elementary Islamic religious education, which was not a reflection of what Islamic religious education was before independence. During colonial times, for example, in the schools where most of the citizens of the Sultan would go, one would start with a Quran class, what was referred to as a KC, a Quran class, and then a kindergarten, and then standard one, then standard 1A, standard 1B, standard 2, standard 3, standard 4. Now, in the Quran class, students would be taught the Quran, to recite the Quran in Arabic, just as it would be taught in the madrasas. In fact, some of the teachers who were teaching this subject in schools were ex-Quran madrasa schools. So they would be employed by the government to teach students the Quran. And then, of course, there was Arabic, proper Arabic, that was being taught in schools as well. And when it came to religion, it was religion proper. Jurisprudence part of it, the history part of it, the elementary translation of the Quran, etc. But after independence, these things were pulled out and just a semblance of it was left. Now, and then of course, there was this attempt to abolish the Qadi's courts. They could not directly abolish them, but what they did to blunt the effectiveness of the courts was to introduce English, making it compulsory for one to be a Qadi, that one should know English. This was not a condition during colonial times, but after independence, it was made a condition deliberately to keep out those who could really be competent Qadis, people with the knowledge of Islamics. The tendency was one would go to school and wouldn't have much time to attend the Islamic study circles where he would have the higher knowledge of, for example, the Islamic jurisprudence. One would not have the time to attend classes in the mosque. So most of those who would have spent time in schools to know English would be the ones who would not have had an opportunity to find time to study Islamics. I'm speaking after the independence. So when you insisted that a Qadi must speak English, he would have a rudimentary knowledge of Islamics and a lot of English. The result was those who could have qualified to be Qadis didn't have the opportunity to be Qadis because now they have to write their judgments in English. So this was used as a form of diluting whatever they had undertaken to do after independence. Of course, initially, when we got independence, there were Muslims in the civil service, there were Muslims in universities as lecturers, there were Muslims in parastatal bodies, but this was a carryover of what was there under the colonialists. Those who were already in the service were not thrown out, but as soon as the time for their pension has come, for retirement, then nobody else would move in. The result is, if you compare, for example, the administration, there were some of the ex-sultan's subjects who were DCs and DOs. We had a number of brothers who were university lecturers. Some of them, you know them. There were a number of ambassadors, but these were the appointments that were made before independence, because these people had been placed in the positions where they would be observed and taken care of. But as soon as that generation was phased out, we haven't have a strong presence in the civil service and other government institutions. Then another injustice was miome. Miome is M-I-O-M-E, is Mombasa Institute of Muslim Education. This was an institute that was established during colonial times, and contributions, financial contributions for the establishment of this institute were made by the Sultan of Zanzibar, the Aga Khan, the British government, and a philanthropist in Mombasa who donated the piece of land on which this institute was built, about 35 acres. He was a Mombasa wealthy man called Hamis Muhammad bin Juma. Immediately after independence, this was an institute that was established during colonial times to train Muslims from all parts of East Africa, trained Muslims from Kenya, from Uganda, from Tanganyika, from Zanzibar, in technical subjects. So it produced a lot of engineers, electrical engineers, motor engineers, navigators. Even navigation was a subject that was taught, and other technical subjects. These were spread all over East Africa. We had a number of Muslims, young Muslims, who had the position in government. We still have some of them in Zanzibar and some of them in Uganda. But in Kenya, you don't have any. This Mombasa Institute of Muslim Education, immediately after independence, Kenyatta grabbed it, took it over, and is now referred to as Mombasa Polytechnic. The sad part of it is Muslims who attend this polytechnic at present are less than 5% of the total population of the students in that institute. So this was another injustice that was done immediately after independence. Then there's question of national status. Yes, they agreed that all the ex-Sultan subjects would be Kenyans, but the situation in the field is not so. For example, if a young man who is newly born and he attains the age of 18, in Kenya, one must have an identity card. Now, to get that identity card, if you bear a Muslim name, you'd be required to produce your birth certificate, your father's birth certificate, your grandfather's birth certificate. Once you bear a Muslim name, this is the same with a passport, whereas a non-Muslim would go there and get it just using his own name. So this has forced Muslims to find themselves as if they don't belong to that country. Recently, to prove this in Parliament, a Luo MP, this is an MP from the Nyanza province, stood up and said how unfair this is and how unjust it is by citing a case of two Luo brothers, two full brothers, Luo brothers. One had a Christian name to his Luo surname. The other had a Muslim name to his father's surname. They were of the same father. Now, this MP cited this case and said the one with the Christian name got his ID, but not the one with the Muslim name. He had to produce birth certificates of his fathers and his grandfather. So this was another case of the injustices that we have in the country. Then we come to land. Now, a lot of the land in the protectorate, when the British colonialists came, turned them into trust land. They took away some of the land from the people themselves and made them crown lands, for example, that they belong to the British government. Now, so there was a lot of land that could not be claimed by individuals as their land, however long they might have stayed. We are not speaking of vast pieces of land. The land on which your house was built by your ancestors, you had no right to it. You stay there at the mercy of the government. For example, you go to Lamu District, Bajuni Islands, Bajuni Mainland. There are no title deeds for the inhabitants, the residents of that area. But somebody coming from outside that area would have a title deed. So all these people who are originally there for centuries don't have any title to the land. They are the tenants of the government. They could be pushed out any time. Now, but what is most painful is when the independent government wanted to look for settlements for some of their people upcountry, they would look for land at the coast. There's been a lot of land that belongs to the European settlers. These were bought, the British government gave some funds to the Kenya government on loan, and they used this money to buy some of these vast lands, not in the name of the respective communities, but in the name of individuals. So Kenyatta would grab every land that belonged to European settlers. Other leaders would come into that as well, and they would share all these lands. Now, normally, these would be people who the settlers allowed to settle with huts built in the land, but now they are being forced out. Who by? By the Africans who said they were fighting for that land to revert to them. So they would push them out of the land they had bought. Where do they send them? To the coast. So in Shimba Hills, one of the settlements was Shimba Hills, in the south of Mombasa, in the Kwale district, you had upcountry people given plots with their title deeds. Whereas the people surrounding them, the Digos and the Durumas, would not have that land. Come to Lamu, a place called Mpeketoni. The government would send Kikuyus with title deeds for these plots, whereas the Bajunis, the Pokomos, the Galas would not have any right to this land. Again, they would sell some of these plots to foreigners coming from outside Kenya to invest, build villas or build hotels. They would give them the title deed to own that piece of land and remove the natives from that area. Some of the administrators, particularly our Kikuyu brothers, some of them own islands in the Lamu district. They have their title deeds and that belongs to them. So this was another injustice that was done to the coast Muslims. Well, one might rightly point out, what about Somalis? Are they Muslims? Because right now you find Somali ministers, Somali generals in the army, Somali provincial commissioners, Somali district commissioners, Somali education officers, Somali district officers, etc., etc. They are there. They are holding these posts. But the question is, were they given these posts because they were Muslims or because they were Somalis? In Kenya, there is this belief which has been perpetuated by a lot of repetition that Somalis are not Arabs. Arabs, as I mentioned earlier, were slave traders, Somali weren't. And then Somalis belong to Somalia, which is in Africa. Muscat or Oman is not in Africa. This was what Banakai mentioned when I was an MP in my maiden speech. Mboya kept on interrupting me as I spoke. And he got to a point where he told me, go back to Arabia. So I turned to him and told him, you go back to the Sudan. Because at least Luos said they came to Kenya then 70 years ago, where Arabs had been to Kenya over 1,000 years ago. So who has the greater right to be a Kenyan? So when he told me, go back to Arabia, I told him, go back to the Sudan. And he shouted, Sudan is in Africa. And I told him, nonetheless, in the Arab League. So this is the same case with Somalia. Somalia, if Somalia is in Africa, it is a member of the Arab League. So why differentiate the two? But the reason why they've accepted the Somalis, despite the fact that they're Muslims, and not the Swahilis or the Digos or whoever at the coast, is because Somalis were aggressive. They fought for several years. Whereas the Mambawis did not fight, did not take up arms. So the government feared Somalis. They didn't fear the Mambawis because they've always been peaceful. In fact, it's been repeated every time our politicians come to the coast that you are renowned for your peacefulness. Coast is a very good area. Everything is peaceful. And as Moi would always end his speeches, Mukai hivyo hivyo. That means continue being what you are. Never rise up. So this, in short, was the situation before independence and after independence. But the subject of my talk refers to writing of the injustices. How would we write them? I think there are a number of factors that we have to bear in mind in this one. The first thing is the Muslims have to be united. They have to unite. At present, they are not united. They appear to be united on the face of it, but they are not. They are not united, and the main reason is this cancer of tribalism that reigns in Kenya, throughout Kenya. Tribalism is a big problem. And although as Muslims we are supposed to be united, but the Muslims in Kenya are not yet a homogeneous society. So this is one of the problems that face Muslims. To be able to be effective in fighting for their rights, they have to be united. Secondly, they have to be assertive. As I said, most of us at present are docile. We have to be assertive and aggressive, not necessarily in the military sense, but we have to be aggressive, speak out about our right. Now, of course, this requires awareness, political awareness, that as Muslims, they are not foreigners. They are as Kenyans as well. Now, this has yet to be appreciated by the Muslims. I'm sorry to say this. Normally, Muslims do not regard themselves as part and parcel of the country, particularly now where they are carried away by the young activists that have come up and carried away by this wave of pan-Islamism, where they would be more interested in what is going on outside Kenya than what is going on within Kenya itself. And this is largely because of the leaders themselves. They are not that conscious. Of course, we have had some successes by being assertive, but it's not a sort of an organized form of movement. We have had successes, for example, with the IPK. There was an organization in the 80s and 90s, IPK, which is Islamic Party of Kenya. Government refused to register it. But it was so active, and it brought the government to its knees at that time. Even some of the politicians, upcountry politicians, who were fighting Moi, this was during Moi's time, some of the upcountry politicians who were fighting Moi wanted to join IPK because they discovered that it was the most effective party against the then president of Kenya. to a point where the government sent some of its officers to the Muslims, went to the Muslim elders, and said, look here, why all this problem? What is it that Muslims want? The government is ready to give to you. But the leader who was then the leader of IPK was a young man called Balala. He was almost mentally deranged. I mean, the power he had, I mean, if he called a strike and said shops should not be opened, shops will not be opened, however much the government would assure the shopkeepers of security, they would just not open. He was that powerful. He was so powerful that normally when the president comes to Mombasa, he would have a motorcade throughout from the airport to the state house. It reached a point where at one time the president came to Mombasa, he could not drive to the state house. He had to fly by a helicopter because he had sort of marshaled his activists along the route that the president would pass. Now, that power he had. So when the government discovered that there was no way they could handle him, they sent a delegation to meet some of the Muslim elders, I being included then, to say, could you speak to your young man and let him say what is it that you want? The government is ready to accept all your demands. But the young man would not listen, and the masses would not listen to the old man. So when he said nothing doing, it was nothing doing. Recently, of course, there was this Council of Imams and Preachers of Kenya, which worked closely with the organization, which is led by Raila Odinga. And it was effective in getting votes for the then opposition. For example, in Mombasa, all the MPs that were elected in Mombasa were members of the opposition party and along the coast. So the majority of the MPs elected in the last election from the coast were anti-KANU government. But then this was something that was spontaneous. It wasn't sort of worked out and organized. This assertion, in my view, should be made by Muslims within the mainstream of political parties. Muslims have to join these political parties, be within them as members of that party, and being cautious of what they would go for, and try to influence in the discussions of the party some of these things. Most of it is brought about by prejudice and ignorance. You meet people who do not seem to know why they believe what they believe against Muslims. They just find that this is the belief and we are with it. But once you educate them about these things and let them know about it, they seem to understand. It's something that the prejudices are very much confined to a clique in the ruling class, and this is largely because they fear of the influence of some of the Muslims outside the system. However, again, the problem here is Muslims isolate themselves by not joining these parties. We have left it to individuals. Yes, we have very strong Muslims with strength within these organizations. A very good example was this man called Sharif Nasir. Sharif Nasir was in KANU, and he was a very powerful Muslim from the coast in Moi's government. Moi would very much listen to him because he threw his all into the party, and he was involved in the higher echelons of the party. But that was an individual. He would be trusted. And if you are close to Sharif, then you'd get whatever others are getting. It requires his nod. Say, this is the man. But it was left to an individual. Just right now, as it is with some of the Muslims who are in the government, people like Balala, Mwakwere, Abu Chiaba, these are people who are in the system. As individuals, they could use their position to help the Muslims outside. And normally, whatever they would say, government would accept. But had Muslims organized themselves to join some of these organizations and work from within it to influence the policy being made on the running of the country, I think we would have a different story. In this case, Somalis, who are Muslims, have succeeded much, apart from the fact that they were shifters, apart from the fact that they fought the government. But now, because they are in some of these political parties, they are in these positions, they are able to advance their interests, not as Muslims, but as Somalis. And this is the situation. I think I'm sorry, I cannot continue much longer. I'm not confident of my English. I would stop here. Thank you very much.